Good morning. It's 9 after 6. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. One of the things that Republicans and Democrats in the state legislature have been wrangling over during the past week or so is virtual schools. Actually, it's more about the Republicans wrangling with the governor, but since an appeals court ruled that virtual schools violate the state's charter school law, legislators have been working to find ways to keep the online schools up and running for the 3,500 or so students currently enrolled. And just when they thought they had a compromise that worked, up pops the governor with a veto threat. This morning we're going to talk about virtual schools, the pros, the cons, the politics, the future of virtual schools. You can help us do that by calling 800-642-1234, toll free. Again, that's 800-642-1234, and it's a toll free number. Or if you're in Madison, use our local number 263-1890, 263-1890. We have an email address, talk@wpr.org. My guest this hour is Steve Correa, an associate professor of teacher education at St. Norbert College in De Pere. He joins us by phone. Good morning, Professor Correa, and welcome.
Good morning.
Well, let's give some background for those who may not have been following this. What is a virtual school and how do they work?
Obviously a great place to start. One of the things about virtual schools is, of course, it delivers instruction via the Internet. And so we have web-based instruction where students can really be in any location. I think we're primarily talking homes that students can then take online classes. This might involve video conferencing, submission of assignments electronically, and it really allows the instruction to be delivered and the learning to take place regardless of the venue. So it can take place anywhere. So the brick-and-mortar model that most of the listeners have experienced would be irrelevant in this particular case because, again, everything's delivered electronically.
So I would assume that that virtual schools would be quite popular among parents who wanted to homeschool their children.
Virtual schools have become very, very innovative in that it allows a lot more flexibility with time. Students are able to work at their own pace. It is a very popular model for parents that, for one reason or another, do not see the brick-and-mortar, the traditional model of education, as viable for their children.
Now, I understand that virtual schools are pretty big elsewhere in the world. How have they? How accepted are they in the United States? How common are they?
And that's a great way to start. And I think, you know, if we look at it this way, there are about 50 to 55 million students in K-12 education in the United States. And most of the recent research shows that about 2 million of those students are taking classes online or in a virtual school setting. And of that, about 2 million, a little over 70% are high school-based students. And we have, in Wisconsin, we're a little late to the game in providing legislation and guidance for this. Wisconsin is also a little unique in that it has been local districts that have provided the initiative for these, whereas in other states, for example, Utah and Florida, these are statewide-based virtual schools. So questions about funding and teachers' associations and those kind of things aren't quite as central to the argument because they're state-based as opposed to district-based.
Just to make sure we clarify the differences between Wisconsin and other states, in Wisconsin there's local control of schools through school boards, and schools are financed, at least in part locally, by local property taxpayers in districts, and that's not true in all states, is
it? That basic model, that's the good old 9th and 10th Amendment of the Constitution with powers reserved to the states and powers reserved to the federal government. But the virtual schools, because they've been created in sometimes as early as the early 90s, have been formulated in a slightly different funding mechanism. And so some of the states were more forward-thinking and looked to the way that they would enroll, match standards and curriculum, and they were able to become more standardized in their organization and delivery. And so what these states did was they preempted local competition for virtual schools with districts competing and instead made them a statewide initiative. And just for example, Utah has an electronic high school, this is a phenomenal number, with over 50,000 students taking classes at any one time.
Boy, I bet they have a great football team.
Can you imagine what those pep rallies are like?
Yeah, no
and,
kidding.
Florida has over 20,000 students enrolled.
Okay.
Now, what that means, though, is they may be taking just a select course or two, or there are a number of students that are doing the entire degree program online.
Okay, and I want to come back to that aspect of it, too, but we're at weather time, so I want to get this break in, and then we'll be back and talk some more with Steve Correa about virtual schools, and we would like you to join us as well. What do you think? Do you have a child enrolled in a virtual school? Are you someone who has some concerns about virtual schools in Wisconsin? You should call in and join our discussion, ask a question, make a comment. You can do that at 800-642-1234 or 263-1890. Or if you haven't had your powder milk biscuits yet today and you're a shy person, you can send us an email. The address is talk@WPR.org. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 17 minutes after 6 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up a little bit later today on the Ideas Network. After 10, Kathleen Dunn and her guest talk about the state of our educational system. Her guest is Frederick M. Hess, Director of Education Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. That's after 10 this morning with Kathleen Dunn. Well, we're talking about education here this hour, specifically virtual schools. And if you've been following the news, it's been pretty hard to miss that there is a bit of a tussle going on between the legislature and the governor after Democrats and Republicans had reached a compromise on how to keep virtual schools open after an appeals court had said that their current structure or setup violates the state's charter school law. Democrats and Republicans in the Senate and Assembly had apparently reached a compromise on a change in the law that would keep these schools open. And then Governor Doyle said, no, that compromise isn't going to work. I'm not going to sign it. And so now we're kind of back to square one, and the legislature is still working on this, and hopefully they'll get things resolved before the legislative session ends. So there's your kind of recap. The score at the end of one quarter, no, it does seem like some sort of a sports contest sometimes. Okay.
I do think, though, that's an important point to be able to say. I mean, our governor has a very strong record of not automatically passing the bills that come to him from the legislative branch, and he really has only signed a little over 50 bills that have come to him from almost 500 that have been passed by one house or the other. So they have to continue the sports analogy, play ball with the governor. And so that's what puts the pressure on this issue with the short time frame.
Yeah, and apparently, I don't know if there was miscommunication or just a lack of communication, but, I mean, the Senate Democrats and the Assembly Republicans had worked something out, and one would have assumed that since there was a Democrat and a Republican in the room and they were agreeing on something, that somebody must have told the governor. So I don't know what happened there, but that's we talked about that a little with Sean Johnson yesterday, and that's not what we're here to do this morning. Just before the break, you were talking about how virtual schools work and are funded in other states who have set things up differently and made them statewide schools and have taken care of that in the as part of the state budget. In Wisconsin, how are virtual schools funded?
And that is a large issue of contention. That was also an issue with the court ruling back a couple months ago. Each student in Wisconsin ostensibly has an amount of money that they are given to be able to fund them to go to a public school. And it's approximately $6,000, give or take. You can go either direction, depending on your district. The legislature attempted to be able to say, okay, we're going to set an amount for each student if they so choose to enroll in one of these virtual schools. And they set it at about, I think, $5,850, something like that. That's the amount that the legislative branch is looking at. And so then if a child in Superior would decide to enroll in the Connections Academy in Appleton, then that $5,850 would follow them, at least their virtual enrollment, to Appleton to be able to defray the cost of providing that education that the Appleton Virtual School does from Superior. So that money geographically transmits from Superior, well, Madison to Superior, then down to Appleton.
So the Superior District loses that money.
Exactly.
Okay, so school districts, so there are 3,500 students enrolled in virtual schools right now, and so each of those 3,500 students, we don't know, well, we know, I mean, we, you and I probably don't know where they all are, but somebody does, and so in each of those cases, that amount of money is being removed from their local school district's budget and placed in the school district budget of the location of the virtual school, which in this case, you mentioned Connections Academy, is in Appleton. So Appleton would be a net winner here, and all the other districts would be net losers.
Correct. And it is a financial transfer. So it does have a financial impact, positive or negative, on these, you know, two respective districts. I do think it's important to note, though, and the Appleton superintendent, I think, has been very, very good at getting this particular word out, if people would listen. Appleton, as an example, is not getting rich at this. They're not turning much more of a profit on individual, if we want to call it a profit, on individual students enrolled in the virtual than they are in individual students enrolled in brick-and-mortar schools. You know, they're not talking much money. I've heard the number $100 or so per student once they defray costs, pay teachers, all the other kind of things that they have to do. So I think Appleton and a number of these other, Janesville, they're looking at this as a complement to existing schools. And a lot of people in the traditional schools are looking at this as a threat to traditional schools. And perhaps the most healthy way to look at it is a challenge, in that it really ends up giving a much wider menu of options to parents and local school districts.
Well, I can see, though, that if you're a school administrator in a school district that's on the edge financially already, and now you have to compete with something hot like a virtual school. I mean, these things are sexy as all get out. You would have some serious concerns if you lose in some of these districts, if they lose a half a dozen students, you know, that's a pretty significant piece of their budget. And if they're on the edge already, and you've got a lot of districts, particularly I would think in northern Wisconsin, that are property rich and tax poor, that this would be a really big issue for them. I don't understand exactly why in the state of Wisconsin the way that schools are financed appears to create this kind of winner and loser game between districts. If the state wants to start a new program, then shouldn't they finance it in some way other than taking money out of the budgets of local school districts?
That is absolutely the issue. In Wisconsin, we continue to put districts that are already at financial strain, continue to be, and even more so. And that's one of the problems with the Wisconsin funding formula, is that as these students de-enroll, I think I just invented that word, and go to other districts, that money goes with them, and then those more rural districts or financially at-risk districts lose even more. An interesting thing to be able to note is in virtual schools nationally, almost 25% of rural-based students take a virtual class or an online class, whereas urban districts, it tends to be no more than 10%. So, you know, we have a formula that is increasing the stress on rural districts to be able to continue to operate their traditional brick-and-mortar schools. And again, that's where Wisconsin is far behind the curve in this. And that's where other states have addressed this far out in front by addressing the funding issue and being more forward-thinking with how we're going to incorporate this. Wisconsin is playing a catch-up game here.
Let's take a call. We've got some people who are interested in joining our discussion, and that's what we're here for. So we will press the appropriate button. And here's Janine in Green Bay. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good.
I heard a program on public radio maybe 3, 4, 5 months ago. WEAC wants to get rid of virtual schools because more teachers will be hired. Also, they'll make more money on their dues.
Well, WEAC is WEAC is a is the kind of the political arm of the teachers union, so
exactly.
They don't collect dues or hire teachers.
But there will be more teachers hired if you eliminate the virtual schools. Maybe they won't be in power or control, but they'll be hired.
Let's ask the professor. If we get rid of virtual schools, will that result in a net increase in the number of teachers who are in classrooms?
Well, I think first, that's a great question. We're not going to get rid of virtual schools any sooner than we get hover cars. So they are here to stay. But WEAC has been, and the caller's very astute, WEAC has been very upfront with the lawsuit. They were the ones that pressed this forward. And what WEAC wants to do is to place controls on these and to be able to define teachers and that they be certified teachers. And so WEAC is really, I think, not a bit of a horrible tightrope, but it's a political tightrope because on the one hand, they want to control and to be able to have respectable educational standards that are state-based. On the other hand, they do see this as an unknown challenge to traditional teaching, and they don't know that. So they're really trying to put the brakes on things and encourage the governor and other Democratic legislators to be able to have an audit or a study done of virtual schools so that we know what's going on within the state of Wisconsin. But clearly, there are ramifications for hiring teachers and all these other kind of issues. So the caller's correct that there is an issue with teachers and the traditional teacher unions within Wisconsin, and WEAC, again, I think, is just trying to get their arms around the issue and understand it better.
Well, why wouldn't we want certified teachers in teaching virtual schools?
Oh, that's exactly true. We do want virtual teachers. What we're trying to decide is how exactly does a teacher teach on virtual schools? And do they do that 8 hours a day? Do they do that 4 hours a day and perhaps provide some support services within the traditional school setting? How do we organize those teachers' times? How does this relate to teachers? Can you teach part-time? And then if you teach part-time at a virtual school, do you necessarily, you need to be certified? That seems to be a strong consensus in the state, that I don't think that's going to end up being an issue or is an issue. But exactly what that role for that classroom teacher would be in the virtual school, and would they be a union member, those kind of things. And those are unknown.
Well, we'll certainly find out more about this as we move forward. The legislature has, depending on who you ask, just days or possibly weeks left in the session to get this problem fixed. And so far, all the handicapping that I've seen in the press has said that this is a toss-up as to whether this gets done or not. There are a number of editorials that have come out. All of them are in favor of working out a compromise and asking Governor Doyle to work things out with the legislature so that virtual schools can remain a part of the education landscape here in Wisconsin. Well, we certainly look forward to hearing more from our listeners on this topic. You can reach us at 800-642-1234. We'll be taking more calls right after we have some news here in just a few seconds. 800-642-1234. Or 263-1890. Do you have a student enrolled in a virtual school? Call in and talk to us about that experience and what you think of it. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 6:35. I get the words out this morning. This hour on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network, we're talking about virtual schools. There is some controversy in the state over virtual schools as an appeals court judge ruled that they violate the state's current charter schools law. And since then, legislators have been working on a way to find a change or to create a change in the law that everybody could get along with, including the governor, and they haven't quite gotten there yet. So we're talking about virtual schools, and we invite you to join the conversation, we will welcome your phone calls at 800-642-1234 or 263-1890. My guest this hour is Steve Correa, an associate professor of teacher education at St. Norbert College in De Pere, who joins us by phone. By the way, you can send us an email as well. The address is talk@wpr.org. Now, we've talked about some things about virtual schools. You mentioned that there were some high school students who might take one or two courses online. Of the 3,500 students who are enrolled in virtual schools in Wisconsin, how many of those are, is that what we call an FTE number? Is that a full-time equivalent, or is that a head count? And how many students are just taking one or maybe two courses?
Sure, and I think that's a really good question. And one of the problems is exactly getting to that information. And I have to be real honest, with that particular number, I know what the total enrollment is, but I don't know if that's, as you said, an FTE number or a per head or how they're computing that. But one of the changes that's happened since most of us were in high school is that what a lot of students will do is they might want to free up parts of their day in the traditional school to take, say, seven subjects, and then at home they can enroll for one or two courses in an online school and be able to take an advanced math or an AP class or, you know, whatever the choice. And it positions them very well to be able to, you know, hit the ground running, as it was. And so there are a lot of permutations that students are taking to get into and to take classes at virtual schools. It's not always, you know, an all-day activity. Also, the legislature doesn't have a choice here. If this bill or a bill like it isn't passed, most of the virtual schools in Wisconsin have to shut down by court order. So the reality of the pressure on them to get something out is significant. And that's why this, you know, this little tussle between the between the branches is important, because they only have 2 weeks, at least, you know, till they're out of session.
Well, Ed, yesterday, Sean Johnson, our state capitol reporter, suggested that this Wednesday might be the last day of the session for the assembly. So the objects in the rearview mirror may indeed be closer than they appear.
Yeah, and the assembly has proposed an 8,700 total student enrollment limit.
And that was based on a percentage of the total number of schools enrolled, or total number of students enrolled in schools statewide, wasn't it?
Exactly. And then the governor wants to hold it more in the 3,500 level, the current level, with perhaps a 1% growth. Now, to the untrained political observer, it seems that the area of 6,000 is a wonderful compromise area, but I don't know if that will necessarily come about. But certainly the governor said, hey, guys, remember me. I'm over here. I have the nice office on the second floor. You have to pay attention to me. And as you mentioned earlier in the report, they were not quite sure why he didn't get involved in those earlier discussions.
Well, I think there was a certain amount of assumption. I know when I talked to Sean Johnson yesterday, there was some surprise. Apparently, we don't know if they weren't talking or if messages got mixed or what, but it was kind of a surprise the way things came down. I want to go back to something, and I hate to keep picking on this, but I have two elementary teachers in my family, my wife and daughter, and so I hear about these issues all the time, not virtual schools so much, but a lot about funding and things. So if a student is taking one course in a virtual school and the rest of their courses are all in their school district, how do they figure out, is there a percentage of the money that goes back and forth? I'm trying to get my hands around this.
That is just a wonderful question. And once again, it shows that Wisconsin has been behind the curve in providing established, well-understood, and put-in-place practices and policies regarding the funding and delivery of instruction. These issues have been addressed in many other states, and that depends on which virtual school you're enrolling in. Now, if it's an in-district one, and since I live in Appleton, I'm more familiar with this one, if you're an in-district student and you go to Appleton East High School, you can take one or two courses at a virtual school just because that's part of what you get from being enrolled in the Appleton School District. Those coming from outside the district, around the state, there are different policies with what these individual courses cost. UW Extension. Some listeners might have taken a course from that. Wonderful program, of course, a very early online-based program. They have tuition and expenses that have to be paid for that. So it just depends on the district and the course and how many you're taking and, you know, the equipment that you have at home. Do you have to be able to get, you know, particular upgrades and whatever? So it's a real mishmash, and it is not consistent. And again, it has the initiative has been with these districts that are trying to be forward thinking, and the vision and the guidance has not been coming from Madison, whether it's DPI or the governor's office or the state legislature. And so districts have been the ones out in front, and that's what's led us to the court ruling and all of these other kind of issues. So, you know, districts are trying to do what they see is important for their local students. But again, there it has, you know, serious impact on funding and other issues.
Here we have an email from Saul in Stevens Point. Where is the discussion of educational rigor in virtual schools? The witnesses in favor of virtual schools in Wisconsin cited, one, that their child was shy and felt uncomfortable in a public school, or two, that their child was in kiddie rodeo, I'm assuming that that's some sort of a metaphor, and had to miss too much conventional school. These were our reasons to defund public schools? Question mark. Because WEAC is opposed to virtual schools is not a reason to support them. Virtual schools are the American dream of learn while you sleep. Wake up. The jobs you used to have are going to countries where work is still a part of education and teachers are respected. That from Saul and Stevens Point.
Yeah, I think I can deal with part of that. I don't know that I can deal with all of it.
Well, some of it was a commentary. There was a question in there someplace, but deal whichever part of it you'd like.
And I think that Saul asks a really good question or raises an important issue. There are very limited, but there are studies that exist that have looked at virtual schools. Now, one of the challenges is comparing apples to apples. For example, it's very easy to be able to look at student performance in a virtual school versus student performance in a brick and mortar, but you may not be comparing apples to apples. For example, are you looking at 11th graders taking AP calculus, and are you looking at the same type of instruction and unit? You know, it's very difficult to get those consistencies across studies. We do know in some studies that students that have been enrolled in virtual schools do as good or slightly better than traditional students in AP tests and AP classes. Now, that's an important finding because that means that they're not doing damage and they perhaps are performing slightly better. So there is some evidence to show that virtual schools do well, but Saul is exactly right. We don't know. How long are these students taking classes? How long does it take? What do the teachers do? You know, how do they interact, et cetera, et cetera? So there's a lot we do not know.
Well, one thing we do know is that we're at weather time, and so we'll take a break and come back and pick up the discussion. And one of the things I want to talk about, and the phones are starting to back up, so I want to get to some more calls here. I want to find out about how students are enrolled. In other words, do virtual schools have to take any student who applies? Do they have to offer special education courses? And who pays for the equipment that needs to be used? These are some questions that we'll try and deal with after we take a break and check weather around the state of Wisconsin. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network. Here's what's coming up next hour. We're going to talk about the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. A lot was made of it during the last presidential debate between the Democratic candidates Obama and Clinton. And so we'll take a look at the North American Free Trade Agreement 14 years after it went into effect and kind of see where we are with it now. This hour, we're talking about virtual schools with our guest, Steve Correa, an associate professor of teacher education at St. Norbert College in De Pere, who joins us by phone. And we do want to take some phone calls because we've got full phone lines, but I still have some pretty important questions I really want to make sure we address. Particularly, do virtual schools have to take any student who applies, and do they also have to offer special education courses?
And again, really good question. They need to provide the same kind of services that all districts provide. So there is an open enrollment in period in Wisconsin, which just closed, and that's where these students then make their intentions known to be able to enroll in these virtual schools. Theoretically, these virtual schools can enroll an unlimited number of students. Realistically, they do put a cap on them because there are teachers back at home, or at the home base, that need to be able to provide support services and instructional techniques to those students. So, no, there are caps with each of those schools. They do have room for expansion, but they would have to hire more teachers. Special needs students actually find this of great value, again, because there's not the transportation expenses. The parents don't have to get these children ready, perhaps with they might be profoundly physically disabled, but cognitively, you know, a 100 IQ score. So, no, those students can also be able to enroll in those special or in those Connections Academy or whatever the case it might be. And the advantage with them is it actually makes their lives easier with special needs students because, again, they don't have to go through the rigmarole to get the student to school. They can start learning in a more comfortable environment right at home.
And who pays for the equipment that's required to be involved in the virtual schools? And obviously, you need a pretty robust internet connection as well.
Absolutely. Most of these schools provide an internet subsidy. So, you know, to plug Roadrunner or whoever the case it might be at home. And then they loan the equipment if the person does not have equipment that they're able to have. So the school districts just loan that. And you can see now, you start looking at this high-tech equipment. It has to be good equipment. Goes out to local district or local students around the state. That is owned, for the most part, by the local school district, the virtual school. And then it's loaned for the enrollment time. And then it comes back in or they upgrade as necessary with software or hardware.
Let's go to the phones, and I want to take a call from Rose in Mukwonago. Rose, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen. I am calling because I have four children enrolled in the Wisconsin Virtual Academy. I'm very interested in your conversation this morning, and you're right. We're in the home stretch of a fight to save these schools, and they are a complement to our public education, as it has always traditionally been. And the conversation about so much about the dollars, that issue has been settled in this conversation about these schools. These are revenue-neutral exchanges here, no impact on the taxpayers, whether a parent like me decides to use my local school or to enroll in an online public school. And these schools run for two-thirds of the cost of my local school. They're very cost-effective, and they serve kids who are thriving and have struggled in traditional classroom settings. And I just wanted to say that there are only, out of all of the students who attend K through 12 public education in Wisconsin, only 0.3% attend virtual public schools. You began your discussion talking about online education. Of course, that's much more prevalent. Many brick-and-mortar schools use online instruction, and children do well with a mix of classroom and online instruction. But this legislation and the schools that we're talking about dedicate themselves entirely to online instruction in a cost-effective, excellent way. All of the teachers are certified. Your discussion about teachers, the teachers are veterans, state-certified faculty. The new measure requires all schools to have teachers who are certified in the subject area in which they're teaching. We applaud, parents of virtual public schools applaud the new accountability measures that these bills put into place and the audit. We're very happy to have this model looked at very closely because it's something for Wisconsin to be proud of, and we ask that it continue to be just an option for the small number of students who do so very well in it And just wanted to raise that issue this morning. Thank you.
Well, hang on a second, Rose. I just wanted to clarify something you said toward the beginning there about these schools being revenue neutral. That's already been taken care of. You said they were revenue neutral as far as taxpayers were concerned. Are they revenue neutral as far as school districts are concerned? That was the issue we were discussing earlier.
Well, if your concern is service to children and giving them the best public education that the state can, a public education that serves their needs, then you're less concerned about how the dollars are spent. The dollars are the same. They go to a public school. It may not be the community school, but that is not the school educating the child. The open enrollment system is very common sense. A third of the dollars allocated to an individual child stay in the home district for the maintenance of their buildings, for the fixed costs that they have. And only two-thirds go to the school that's actually educating the child. So it's a bit of a smokescreen to talk about these schools hurting local districts. It's these schools are a complement to local district education. It does force us to look at our paradigm a little bit differently, but it does not hurt taxpayers, and neighborhood schools are not providing services to the students. They're invisible to the students. They're, for instance, my children, when they enrolled in the online public school, our school district received funds for them for the first time and has never given them any services at all. So you could see it the other way also, that as more students are drawn into the virtual public schools, local districts benefit.
Okay, thank you so much for that call, Rose. It was very illuminating.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your conversation very much as we look to the governor to solve this issue this week and do what we know he will to protect public education for all kids in the state.
So, Professor, you'd like to follow that up, or I can go to some more calls?
Yeah, I do think one quick comment is important here. This does have an effect on local school districts. I mean, we can't pretend that the removal of almost $6,000 per district does not have an effect on the bottom line of local school districts. So earlier you had mentioned the state funding formula. That's a real issue here. Now, that is also a real political quagmire, and I don't think that Wisconsin has the political will right now to be able to address that. That's probably going to be done by courts. However, this does take money from some local school districts. We can't pretend otherwise. Now, she's talking about a greater good, a higher ethic, and I applaud. This is obviously a woman who's very dedicated and a strong supporter of virtual schools for her children. But, there are some districts that are really caught between a rock and a hard place here. And this is where we're looking for leadership from Madison on the entire student body of the state of Wisconsin, and we don't have that just yet. So it's a wonderful compliment. I like her term of compliment, but these other issues have to be addressed because rural districts are getting squeezed and hurt from lots of areas. This is just one other potential area of depleting money.
Yeah, I could see that there would be some larger school districts. Well, if they lose one or two students to open enrollment, that wouldn't be such a big deal. But you take some of these really small rural districts, which may be one or two students away from having to just close the door. What happens to those other students who wouldn't have any school then?
Oh, exactly. A school district like Gresham, which just recently came into being, or Stockbridge on the east shore of beautiful Lake Winnebago, these districts, boy, if they would have a large migration to virtual schools, they would be under terrific pressure. But then the consolidation issue in Wisconsin, I think, is going to appear soon anyway.
Let's take a quick call before we have to leave from Steve in Barron, who's been very patient. Thanks, Steve, for staying online.
Yeah, no problem. Hey, I totally agree with the last caller. I think the money issue is not saying it's irrelevant, but, you know, if the district is not servicing the child, you know, you can't expect to get the money. And that's just where I'm going with that. But I ran into this back in 98. I was in the technical school system. I think what the whole issue here is change. Back in 98, there was a bunch of us students in the technical school system that decided we didn't want to travel all over the state to follow the teachers to these classes. So they set us up with basically what was considered at that time like a virtual school, where you would walk into a classroom, say in Rice Lake or in Ashland, but your instructor would be in New Richmond.
Yes,
and
sir.
Everybody said, oh, it'll never work. It'll never work. Well, I'm here to tell you, 10 years later, it's exactly the same thing that the high schools are using now, where my child is taking a class at the technical school. She walks into her room. There's no teacher there. A screen pops on. The intercom system comes on, and she's facing the teacher. And I just laugh about it because, you know, 10 years ago they said it'll never work, it'll never work. And now I know many kids that are doing it, and I know many school districts that do it, and they don't think nothing of it.
All right, thanks. We got about 30 seconds here. Professor, you want to have the last word?
Well, I think that he's exactly right. Really, what we're looking at here, this is another choice issue. And this allows parents to be able to leverage that choice issue, and it really puts more pressure on schools to look hard at funding and delivery of instruction. And again, there's a lot of unknown, and the unknowns are very disconcerting for public schools. They do well with predictability. This is unknown, and again, leadership and direction is requested. It's needed here.
Thank you so much for spending this hour with us. It's been very educational.
Oh, very glad to. My pleasure.
Steve Correa is Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Leo Duran produced this program, on-air production by Karen Prager. If you'd like a copy of it, you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program 34A, or you can go online at WPR.org and listen to it again. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network.